Court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia.
Dr. Lawyer, idiot chief. For my life with songs of grief, with the yellow fear and fearless eyes. He's temper all the times, the times I
survive. Two Dudes Perspective on Legal Footballing. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer, dude, and a judge.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am still just duding it.
So you staying warm over there?
Now I am. It was a while, though. Almost a week without any power. It kept getting cold. I said, we can make it. It's just the 60s on the first day. And then the second day, we can make it. It's still the 50s. And then on the third day, well, it's the 40s. And on the fourth day, we said, we got to get a damn hotel room.
Yeah, we didn't lose power to our house during that second ice storm, but during the first ice storm, we did lose our power. We had kind of wave after wave after wave of ice storms coming through our region, which kind of wreaked havoc on everybody.
Yeah, and the first one didn't get me at all. The second one, though, put me out of business. It put two trees. We've got a long hill leading up to where our neighborhood is, and it put two different trees down across a road. And I'd talked to you and said, Michael, do you got a chainsaw? We can come cut this one out. It's not too bad. And you said, well, let me see if I can get the chainsaw. And I said, okay. And I thought, you know, I better go check, see if there's any more. And I walked down the hill, and right as I get to the bottom, here's one that's like 48 inches in diameter. And I said, nah, we're not moving that one. Never mind, Mike. Scratch the chainsaw. We're out of luck.
Yeah, my neighbors had a huge one that fell in between two houses. Luckily, it split them like a field goal kick. Otherwise, it would have smashed one of them.
Man.
It was maybe a 60 or 70 foot tall tree. It was so wide you can get your arms around it. So it was huge.
Well, it looks like a war zone around here now.
Yeah, we had a casualty from when we lost power.
Oh yeah,
we have a fish tank.
Oh,
and I had a fire going in the living room, a wood burning fire, because we didn't have any power and there didn't have any heat. So the temperature in there wasn't too bad. I mean, we had sleeping bags and all that. But our fish tank was in like the little sunroom where there's some windows, and I guess it got too cold in there. And then the next morning I went in there, the fish looked kind of lethargic, and I rushed the tank over in front of the fireplace and tried to revive him. But alas, he was not going to come back.
Oh, so, man. Well, they're not as lucky as alligators, I guess.
Oh, those ones that stuck their snouts up?
Yeah, yeah. Did you see that in Texas where those ponds froze over with alligators and all you saw was their snouts up through the ice and they were like in a suspended animation under the ice?
Yeah.
That was wild.
Well, I did learn a lot about generators. I didn't have one before, but now I have one. I know how to use it, and they're pretty important things to have. I'm going to start preparing for winter season, kind of like how I prepared for hurricane season when I lived in Florida, I think.
Well, we poured the pad to put in a whole house generator because we got natural gas, so we're going to put in a natural gas generator when we were building our house. But as we got to the end, you know, it's like, do you want to finish the kitchen or do you want a generator? Well, I think we need a kitchen more. So with the generator got nixed, but I tell you what, it's gotten back on the list where as soon as I can figure out how to pay for it, I'm going to get me a generator put in.
Yeah. They're pretty important, especially if you don't want to lose your whole fridge and everything else.
You know, I can understand losing the power in that event that we had, because like I say, it looks like bombs went off around here. There are just trees and limbs just destroyed and down everywhere, wires everywhere. So it's no wonder you lost power. What used to get me is we would have perfectly calm, clear days in the middle of the summer. No storms, no wind, no nothing. All of a sudden, the power would just go out for no apparent reason. And it would be down for like 12 hours or something. You're like, what the hell's going on? There's not even a storm. At least you could blame it on wind or something, but there was not even any wind.
Yeah. Yeah, it was almost understandable during this ice storm because it was pretty bad.
Yeah.
I was driving up towards your house and had to turn around because there was a tree across the road in a line down. I thought, that's weird.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was bad, and it's still a lot of debris to clean up.
Well, we are not going to talk about natural disasters and ice storms this entire podcast, this episode of our podcast.
No, it's we're going to talk about an unnatural disaster.
Yeah, an unnatural disaster. And this story, for anybody that might not want to listen to it, it does involve some human trafficking and some people being taken advantage of by attorneys. So if you're worried about listening to that, just be forewarned. So this episode has to do, like I said, with human trafficking, racketeering, compelling and promoting prostitution. And it's somewhat of a local story. It's set in Portsmouth, Ohio, which is about an hour away from here in Huntington, just down the river. And fun fact, did you know that up until 2019, that Huntington was the largest inland port in the United States?
Actually, I knew that. Because I
figured you might.
I was part of it working for the railroad. We dumped a lot of coal bringing it in. I was the trade master here in Huntington, and we brought a lot of coal into Huntington and dumped it. And that's one of the things we used to tell people is that we are the largest inland port in the United States.
Huntington, West Virginia. But we were overtaken in 2019 by Cincinnati.
Yeah. Well, that's because we don't ship nearly the coal we do. So many places have shut down.
And also because Cincinnati annexed a larger swath of the river to make it part of their port.
Oh, okay.
So
they just annexed it.
A couple things at work there.
Yeah.
So they couldn't let us have it. But Portsmouth is on the river. Like I said, it's just down the river from Huntington. And it's like a lot of different places in this area. It's been hit really hard with the opioid epidemic. Before that, there was a lot of meth and other things that were prevalent in the area. A lot of the businesses and things like that have left the area.
It's a big manufacturing community, and most of the manufacturing closed up.
Yeah. And this attorney there, it appears he used this to take advantage of all this downturn to run his own kind of racket. The attorney's name is Michael Mearon, M-E-A-R-A-N, and he was a licensed Ohio attorney. And I say was because the Ohio Supreme Court suspended his license just on February 8th of 2021, just a couple of weeks ago. And so the 75-year-old can no longer practice law in Ohio. The Supreme Court suspended it temporarily pending this this criminal trial and everything and said that he was in immediate danger and action was necessary to stop this predatory threat. So if you see a picture of him and you didn't know any better, you'd see this kind of jolly, bespeckled, elderly man with gray hair. You wouldn't think he was this kind of monster he's been depicted to be in these stories. It's kind of crazy. He was indicted on 18 different counts related to human trafficking over a 15-year span. He ran his own law firm, which was right next to the courthouse. He was actually on city council at one point, too. And evidently, there had been a rumor about him for years, dating back to 2003, that he had been kind of taking advantage of people and you know, kind of a dirty lawyer. And he'd been investigated several times, but nothing really concrete ever happened about it. He was kind of almost hiding in plain sight.
Well, they actually said that initial complaints about him being involved in, like, white slave trafficking date back to the early 1970s. So, I mean, there was rumors about it, unconfirmed rumors, that he was involved in it that far back, that's kind of was something that he fell into as they were just starting their decline.
Well, it really picked up a lot of traction. In 2015, there was an 80-page federal wiretap affidavit from the DEA that stated that Mearon is also a prolific sex trafficker who for decades has supplied his young female clients with drugs in exchange for and as incentive to participate in acts of prostitution. As you had said, those rumors about Mearon have been around for quite some time. And even in 2015, after this affidavit was submitted by the DEA, it really didn't gain any traction until December of 2017, when there was an ex-reporter from the Portsmouth Daily Times that somehow got his hands on this DEA affidavit and started posting it onto a Facebook page. So evidently, the DEA had turned over a lot of this information to the FBI or other authorities, and nobody really followed up on it for whatever reason.
Yeah, it just kind of disappeared. You know, there's a good old boy system, and that's kind of what has been rumored was going on with him and local law enforcement, that they were all benefiting from his stuff that he was involved in. And then it made you wonder. DEA turned over an 80-page report and gave it to the FBI outlining criminal activity, and no one did anything.
Yeah, well, it wasn't a report. It was a wiretap affidavit that they had to use themselves during their investigation.
Mm-hmm.
So it was for a different case. But part of the basis for that affidavit was based on what they had heard and been reported to all these years about him. So, but you're right. The lack of follow through by the authorities and things like that essentially fueled suspicions that the local authorities were basically in cahoots with him, and they were allowing him to trap women in this cycle of drug abuse and sexual servitude, and that the outside agencies didn't really care about the different things that were going on in this small town.
And then on top of that, not only was he getting these women or helping them stay addicted and forcing them to be sex workers, a lot of them, a lot might be an exaggeration, but several of them disappeared. They don't know what happened to them. And then others of them turned up dead. And and it was almost like you had a serial killer working, because these bodies were showing up, and it went from Portsmouth and Chillicothe. Some of these women were from Chillicothe, which is about another 20 minutes north of where Portsmouth is. That's all kind of the same general area. It's between Huntington. We have to drive through both of those going to Columbus. You drive through there. Of course, now they got that cut off that you can go through and cut Portsmouth out, which I'm glad. I hated driving through Portsmouth. That place is so run down.
Oh, it is. It really is. The Cincinnati Inquirer is a large newspaper in Cincinnati, and they picked up the story, and they spent an entire year visiting Portsmouth to investigate the allegations about this this attorney, and they interviewed 65 different individuals and reviewed hundreds of documents, including arrests and court records. So since the Cincinnati Inquirer kind of picked up on the story and said, hey, we're gonna spend some time on this and figure what's going on. They also interviewed 10 women who separately shared different accounts of working for Mirren, and who basically kind of all told the same story about how they came into being sexual servitude to him. And the records show that Mirren had actually represented 6 of those women facing drug charges. So the basic way that he would go about this is that he would either supply the women with drugs or money in exchange for them performing sexual acts for different people. And a lot of these women were drug addicts, and that was the way they got their fix. So they were essentially kind of addicted and bound to him, because that was the only way they could get any drugs or money to fuel their addiction.
Yeah, it was their livelihood, basically.
Super insidious plot. And, you know, as I said, the area has been especially hard hit by drug abuse. You know, prescription painkillers, fentanyl, heroin, and I mean, Portsmouth has a lot of overdose deaths, just like Huntington does. The prosecuting attorney there was quoted in the story as saying, the conditions are ripe for human trafficking. You have drug addiction rampant, you have unemployment, you have poverty, you have built-in group of folks who are desperate, maybe hopeless, they can be preyed upon. And that's exactly what was taking place here. He was preying upon these women like some sort of, I don't even know what the proper term would be.
Well,
really, 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 really bad person.
Yeah, and I mean, they were afraid of him, because if they went to somebody, first of all, they felt like everybody there was in each other's pockets, so they didn't think there was they couldn't go to the local police or anything like that, because they thought they were all involved in it. One of them even had the former police captain's name in her book of people that she was provided to perform services. And you know, they were afraid.
She was one of the ones that disappeared.
Yeah.
She was one of the ones that had disappeared.
So they were afraid that they were either going to turn up dead or missing if they said anything. So hopeless is exactly what they were. They had no hope of getting out of that situation.
Now, I want to talk a little bit more about the DEA investigation, because that actually shed quite a bit of light on everything. But before we get to that, I think there might be a possible motion pending before the court today.
Well, not only possible, but probable. We have back with us our good friends at Green Chef.
Green Chef is the first USDA certified organic meal kit company. You can enjoy clean ingredients you can trust, seasonally sourced for peak freshness.
Ingredients come pre-measured, perfectly portioned, and mostly prepped, so you can spend less time stressing and more time enjoying delicious home-cooked meals.
Green Chef makes eating well easy and affordable with plans to fit every kind of lifestyle. Whether you're keto, paleo, vegan, vegetarian, or just looking to eat healthier, there's a range of recipes to suit any diet or preference.
Green Chef is the most sustainable meal kit, offsetting 100% of its direct carbon emissions and plastic packaging in every box, so you can feel great about what you're eating and how it got to your table.
Every time I come home and a box has shown up, everybody is super excited because we have the different meals to choose from, and it's like, what are we going to cook tonight? And so you open up the box, you find all your ingredients out there, they're pre-portioned, they're delicious, they're fresh, and they're easy to follow instructions too. Usually you can have it ready pretty quickly, about 30 to 45 minutes.
Yeah, we love them. Every one we've had, we've enjoyed, and it's forced me out of my comfort zone because sometimes it'll come with something maybe I haven't tried before, but everything's been so good, I go ahead and eat it anyway, and I'm usually pleasantly surprised.
Yeah, there are some things in there that are a little bit different that I wouldn't think that I would try. It's not something I would order at a restaurant, but it comes in the box, and I cook it up, and it's delicious. So it's definitely broadened my horizons as well.
And you know it's nutritious and delicious.
That's right. And Green Chef is part of the HelloFresh network because Green Chef is owned by HelloFresh, who was one of our prior sponsors on the previous episodes.
Yeah, and their names almost rhyme.
Almost.
So go to greenchef.com/90quart and use code 90quart to get $90 off, including free shipping.
That's greenchef.com/90quart and use the code 90quart to get $90 off, including free shipping.
$90 off. That's almost 100. I mean, it is. If you don't count all the way.
I don't need a calculator to figure that out either.
That's right. So that's a good deal. So bon appetit.
So getting back to that initial DA wiretap, it was in views to investigate phones used by Mark Eubanks, who the DA suspected was a suspected heroin, oxycodone, and steroids dealer. That's where the DEA connection came in because they were starting to investigate him. But part of the affidavit, which was drafted, talked about Mirren quite a bit. The DEA listed 13 target subjects, and even though Eubanks was the primary target, the affidavit depicts Mirren as pretty much just an important figure as Eubanks in the whole scheme. The affidavit states that the investigation was predicated on the illegal activities of Mirren, and at one point refers to the criminal enterprise as the Eubanks/Mirren organization. So the DEA, when they started investigating this, they really felt like this guy, this attorney, he was in real deep with this Mark Eubanks, who was the drug dealer. And that's part of their affidavit, was the connection between those two. The affidavit talks about a symbiotic relationship between them in which Eubanks would supply the drugs and prostitutes to Mirren, and Mirren arranged for the women to have sex for money and represented arrested associates so he could use his connections to secure favorable treatment. So they were working together to keep these women supplied and drugs and to keep them out of jail and to keep them working and keep making money for them. I mean, it's, you know, really bad.
Probably part of it, there was blackmail involved too, because he would supply these women to people and then keep record of it or whatever, so that then when he needed favors from these people later, he could threaten them with divulging what he knew about them.
Yeah, and he also knew them, and he was well-known in the town. He'd been there an attorney for a long time. So he would find out about active investigations and things that are going on, and he would give Eubanks tips about it. In fact, he once gave the identity of a confidential informant sent to make a drug buy from Eubanks, the affidavit states. So he was giving him kind of inside information as well. In fact, there was in 1 year, there were over 200 phone calls and text messages between Eubanks and Mirren's law office. And one day, they suspect that Eubanks arrived with a thermos, which they suspected had $1,600 in cash that he had gotten from somewhere else to come pay Mirren. So they were definitely, according to the affidavit, at least the investigation, working in cahoots. I think that's probably about the fifth time I've said the word cahoots, which is probably a record for this podcast.
Are you in cahoots with the cahoots company?
Maybe so.
Well, the thing that surprised me when I read this story is the DEA was doing that investigating, and the DEA is only interested in drug crimes. So the DEA concentrated on Eubanks because that's what his part was in that, was the drug part. So they arrested him, and even though they knew that Mirren was involved and that there were crimes that he was involved and they got information about that, they didn't act on any of that because they said that wasn't their concern. They were only concerned with the drugs. And I just don't, that's a big failure on the part of our, you know, law enforcement force if this is the way they think.
Yeah, well, I agree. The federal prosecutors in the Southern District of Ohio indicted Eubanks in October of 2015. He pleaded guilty to conspiracy to distribute heroin. He was sentenced to 150 months in federal prison. And he is now in federal custody. Do you know where he's incarcerated?
Yeah, in West Virginia.
Morgantown, West Virginia.
They made him go to WVU.
Yeah, that's right.
That's prison enough. Spoken like a true Herd fan, huh?
That's right. That affidavit that they used to get the wiretaps and to ultimately convict Eubanks states in the notes that Mirren was a... there have been prior federal investigations into him and numerous complaints to the FBI, and that they had used that as part of the basis for their affidavit to get the wiretap to get Eubanks. Pretty sad the way everything went down. Now, there was one woman who was identified as formerly working for Mirren and said that he would give her $100 every time she would introduce a new woman to him. And another confidential source said Mirren arranged a 2014 trip for her and a second woman to fly to Palm Beach, Florida to have sex with two subjects from New Jersey. And evidently there's airline records, photos, and telephone records which corroborate the Florida rendezvous, according to the affidavit. So there's actually some, it's not just testimony, there's actually some physical evidence that will show that this actually took place.
Yeah, and that the one lady that... kind of got away from it and was willing to speak. No, I guess this was from the one that was missing that they found that book, and it had all these people and it had different notations by them. And also had the phone numbers. And so they called some of these phone numbers in connection with the names that were in the book, and come to find out those were their numbers.
Yeah. And when you say they called, you're talking about her family.
Yeah. Yeah, so because nobody else did anything with it.
Yeah, there's no investigation going on. So, and that's how they came to find out that one of them was supposedly the former police chief.
Right. They called him and it was him.
How'd you get this number?
Yeah. Well, the odds were just stacked against him.
Yeah, absolutely. And Mirren's been linked to 27 women who were working for him. And there was one that's been missing since 2013. And another was found dead of multiple traumas that same year. So I don't know if there's anything that actually involves him with the disappearance or the death, the actual physical act of it. I'm certain that his actions and what he did to them resulted in it, but I don't know that he actually was the one who made the one woman disappear or killed the other one. But, I mean, it's definitely, it sounds very suspicious to me.
Well, it, not only that, what I don't understand, I mean, that's the worst part to me, is that there's like a dozen women that were either found dead or missing since like 2000, something like that, where that have been, they can find a link from all of them to him, and yet no one has done anything about it. Now, there was, I don't know if you saw this, I'd recorded it when it came out. There was a 8-part series that came out in 2015, and it was called Gone, The Forgotten Women of Ohio. And it was about these women disappearing there and the circumstances. Now, I never did watch the whole thing. I watched about half of it, and I didn't watch the rest because nobody else in my family wanted me to have that on TV because it was so depressing. So they wouldn't want to have it on, but there was a bunch of women involved. And there's one of the buildings where they found the body of one of them. I see that building every time I drive by to go to Columbus. I know exactly where it was. It's right off of 23, when you're going up that way, and that's where they found one of the bodies. But they just acted like there's a serial killer in the area, and nobody cares. Nobody's doing anything because these women, in their minds, have no value. They were either drug addicts or they were sex workers or whatever, so who cares? They're not worth investigating. That's all you can figure.
Yeah. So Mirren was indicted in October, and most recently he has decided to represent himself in his own criminal case. And that's called pro se, which in Latin that means for oneself or on one's behalf. And that's what you say when somebody represents themselves, they're appearing pro se. And you have a constitutional right to represent yourself. And he is in fact an experienced criminal defense lawyer. But there is one kind of weird issue that could arise if he was cross-examining his former clients, these women that he represented and forced into this servitude. So if he starts cross-examining witnesses that he's represented in the past and defended them, it could get kind of confusing, and he probably has a conflict of interest cross-examining them. So the judge could preclude him from being able to do that, because if he was their former attorney, he could possibly influence the way they're going to testify, and letting him cross-examine them wouldn't be fair. Because there is a ethical rule that there's concern if the client's interests are in conflict with the lawyer's professional or personal relationships. So it would come down to determine whether or not those people, those women on the stand, they were still actually considered his clients. So they might very well be, even though he's not currently representing them, it's fairly recent. And that might violate the rules of professional responsibility. And this whole thing sounds like a possible MPRE question, the multi-state professional responsibility exam question, mm-hmm. where you have different kinds of weird scenarios, because you don't really have an attorney cross-examining a former client he represented in a criminal matter like that happen. I don't think I've ever seen it happen. So,
well, not only that, it would be very intimidating. These women would be, you know, like suffering from PTSD probably from being through that, and are scared to death of the guy. And to have him cross-examine them would would just be cruel and unusual.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and they've already talked about the different way he exerted power over them by trying to keep them on drugs and trying to force them to do different acts and things like that, and how he was connected with everyone, and you know, it just put this whole persona off that he was untouchable, he was above the law.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there was enough women missing or dead to convince them that wasn't an idle boast.
Yeah, so this is actually kind of a breaking case, because it's pretty current, it's in the news right now. So if you want to stay up to date on it, you can Google this Michael Mirren in Portsmouth and probably find stories about it. So the last thing, like I said, the last thing that just happened, I saw, he was disbarred. Well, not disbarred. He was his license was temporarily suspended on February 8th, which it's a couple weeks ago. And the reason it wasn't revoked just yet is because he still has his criminal trial. I mean, he's still innocent until proven guilty, which, you know, is always an important thing to remember. But looking at everything, all the evidence here that I'm seeing from the story and everything, it doesn't look good. He maintains his innocence, though. He's been talking to the press and everything, saying that, hey, they've been investigating me for years, all these rumors. It's a bunch of disgruntled people.
He said they're all jealous of him.
Yeah, they're jealous of him.
Wait, one of the things they said in that DEA report said, for example, it flatly states that Darren Biggs was one of the 13 targets of the investigation, the DEA investigation. And he had been supplied with prostitutes in the past by Mirren. So it states that as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
But yet no charges or anything were brought forward, because this was from a while back, and nothing was brought forward out of that. And it just states that was just discovered during their investigation. Neither Mirren or Biggs were ever charged with anything concerning that.
No, I mean, I think it goes on and on and on. You just wonder yourself, how did this happen? How did this slip through the cracks like this? And I think you kind of started to hit the nail on the head, because it has to do with a segment of our society that a lot of people don't seem to care about.
Yeah, unfortunately. And there's people like him, I guess, that are willing to take advantage of that.
Yeah. And I mean, people, you know, having defended quite a few people who are addicted and in trouble and not doing well and all that, you know, they are very vulnerable. It's, you have to really try to watch out for them and help them because they can't take care of themselves. So if you put somebody in that situation who's going to take advantage of them, it's not good. It's absolutely not good.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like there was more than one, though, involved. It wasn't just him. It sounded like there was a whole town full of them.
Yeah, but I'm focused on him because, you know, he's the lawyer who's supposed to be representing him, and that kind of gives lawyers a bad name, and I don't like that from my profession. So it hits a little bit close to home because it's not good.
No. So it's the greed in some men's hearts.
I think that goes beyond greed. I think that goes to some sort of perverse, sadistic type thing going on with him. So I did say he was representing himself. And have you ever heard the phrase that a man who's his own lawyer has a fool for a client?
Yeah, I've heard it. I didn't think it was quite like that, but yes, I have heard that.
Who do you think said that?
Probably wasn't Perry Mason. maybe John Marshall.
Well, it's usually attributed to Abraham Lincoln.
Oh, okay.
That's who I've always seen say it.
He was a lawyer.
He was. But according to the Quote Investigator website, and that's actually a website out there, the earliest partial match was in 1682 by William D. Britton. And his quote was, "Before you act, it's prudence soberly to consider, for after action you cannot recede without dishonor. Take the advice of some prudent friend, for he who will be his own counselor shall be sure to have a fool for his client." So
that's a little wordy.
It is, and it doesn't flow off the tongue quite as easily.
No, I couldn't repeat that.
But they, when they say counselor, they may not have meant an attorney per se, not per se, but per se.
Mm-hmm.
Because it could have been anybody that gives counsel, like if you don't listen to a friend or something like that. It was used again in 1692, and this time had to do with physicians. And it said, "He that consults his physician and will not follow his advice must be his own doctor, but let him take the old adage with him. He that teaches himself has a fool to his master."
Well, that sounds like a lot of people have claimed that one.
That's right. And in 1795, this is where it actually comes closest. It says, the British critic was a book review, and it said, it's an old law adage copied from an Italian proverb that the man who is his own lawyer has a fool for his client. So according to 1795 text, it's an old Italian adage that has to do with the law, but nobody really knows exactly where it came from. But supposedly Abraham Lincoln said it.
Well, he maybe did. Maybe he read that Italian book.
So there's another theory about why people think Abraham Lincoln said it, and I really like this one. So do you remember the TV show Bewitched?
Oh, yeah.
So there was an episode called Samantha for the Defense, in which there's a character depicting Benjamin Franklin who had magically been transported from the past. The Franklin character employed the adage, and another character credited the line to Abraham Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
So
everybody figured... Stevens. Yeah, so everybody figured that Bewitched is a source of good information. That was the Wikipedia of the 60s.
That might be. Aaron Stevens, he said, "Mr. Franklin, couldn't you defend yourself?" And Benjamin Franklin, played by actor Fred Wayne, said, "No, that might be unwise, sir. The man who defends himself in court has a fool for a lawyer and a jackass for a client." And somebody said, "Abraham Lincoln said that." And Benjamin Franklin said, "Abraham who? Well, whoever, he stole it from me." So they played on the fact that, you know, that he was from the past and everything like that. So, but I bet that is, if I had to trace it back, that's my theory as to why everyone thinks Abraham Lincoln said that.
Well,
Bewitched.
That could be. That's kind of like what we got into on Neat this week about, you know, the myth that St. Bernard dogs carried those barrels of liquor around to rescue Alpine people stuck in the Alps and avalanches and stuff. Mm-hmm. And that was a painter's imagination, just painted one on this dog. They had seen St. Bernards and were, thought that St. Bernards were beautiful animals and just painted them and put that in. And everybody saw that picture. That picture became popular, and everybody just thought they ran around up there with kegs of liquor.
Now, the one thing you're talking about, why the FBI didn't do anything to arrest these gentlemen whenever they were, I'm not going to call them gentlemen, when the FBI didn't choose to arrest or investigate these guys.
These ne'er-do-wells.
Yeah, definitely. That even falls a little bit short. It's possible, you know, there might not have been any kind of federal crime they could have been convicted of, because the FBI only has federal jurisdiction. But there is one thing in particular that would have applied to that. It's called the Mann Act. And we've talked about that before. Do you remember what that is?
Mm-hmm. That's when you take someone across state lines for sexual purposes.
That's right. And it was most famously used to prosecute Jack Johnson in 1913.
Mm-hmm.
And it's supposed to, it was stated that it was going to prevent human trafficking, and the law was used to protect unlawful premarital, extramarital, interracial relationships. So that was the one federal crime I could think of, because they did allegedly take those women to Florida
mm-hmm.
for that. So at the very
That's
least,
right.
I think the FBI could have just, you know, that was an easy call right there. You already mm-hmm. got that. You've already got the tickets, everything backing it up. But
yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I don't know whether somebody dropped the ball that bad just out of neglect, or whether there was more nefarious things involved.
Yeah. I don't know. I tend to think that a lot of times when something seems like it might be kind of nefarious, it's usually not. It's just people not doing their job or being inept. Now, on occasion, there is some sort of cover-up or nefarious act, but I think it's probably a bit fewer and far between. But this definitely smells, I would say. So.
Well, I mean, if you go back to the 70s, this was at least a 20-year event. And if you go back to the 70s, supposedly when it started, that makes it a 50-year event.
Yeah.
And nobody could determine anything during that time. Nobody cared. Nobody cared enough to do anything about it.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad they're being prosecuted now. The attorney general stepped in from out of town to prosecute it. They investigated and prosecuted it. So there's a special prosecutor from out of town. There's a special judge from out of town. You know, they basically said, "Hey, we're gonna make sure this goes by the book." So.
Well, that's good, because what I saw here, it said the missing or unsolved murders in the local community include Melissa Blevins, who went missing in February of 2010 at the age of 31, Kayla Idle, who went missing January 4th, 2016, Jennifer Shepherd, whose body was found in Pine Creek in Wheelersburg in June of 2013, Angela Holsinger, who has been missing since May of 1998, Nicole Alloway, a North Carolina woman who went missing from Scioto County in June 2009 before her body was found a month later off Route 73 in Ottaway, and one arrest has been made in connection with her death at the time. However, no one has been charged with her murder. I mean, that's just, one is too many, but I mean, it just doesn't make sense that nobody thought to investigate or, you know, put this to an end.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure they're investigating it now, because it's kind of gotten outside the scope of just that small little town. So,
well, between the Cincinnati Inquirer article and a 2015 documentary, it's about time.
I'd say so. Well, that's going to bring us to
legal briefs.
So, legal briefs is a part of the show where I ask Tommy different legal questions based upon something we talked about. And so, the first one I have is, what is the MPRE?
The Multi-State Professional Responsibility and Ethics.
Oh, so close. Exam.
Oh, exam. Responsibility yeah. exam.
Yeah, and that's like one of the parts that you have to take to become a lawyer, where they test your ethical questions. They ask you a bunch of different questions based on what you ethically you should do. And you have to pass that in order to become a lawyer.
Well, that guy is never going to pass it.
Well, he may have never had to pass it to begin with. I don't know when they first started doing the MPRE, but he might not even have to take a bar exam, depending on how long he's been around.
I like to wrap the bar around his neck.
Yeah, he needs something like that. I said he was representing himself pro se. What does that mean?
He wasn't charging himself. It was free. That's sometimes known as pro bono.
No, you know that's not what that is.
I thought it was pretty good. He wasn't charging himself. He was cutting himself a deal.
That's right.
He was charging. He was being his own lawyer, and and that meant he had a fool for a client.
That's right. And pro se in Latin means for oneself or on one's own behalf. And so the issue is that if he's representing himself, then he would get to cross-examine any adverse witnesses under the confrontation clause.
Mm-hmm.
But he may not be able to do that if those were his former clients, because that would be an ethical consideration that the judge would not allow, because he might have some sort of undue influence over his former clients. So it'd be kind of an interesting issue to pop up.
Ted Bundy did that. He represented himself and was cross-examining some of his victims.
Yeah.
But he wasn't a lawyer. He was studying to be a lawyer, but he was not a lawyer.
I think he went to law school one semester or something like that was his claim to fame.
Well, yeah, something like that. I know he thought that he was a hotshot law school student or something.
And lastly, what is the Mann Act?
The Mann Act is the one that says you can't take women across state lines for illicit purposes. And it was a law that was put in place mostly because of, what did you say, Jimmy Johnson or something?
Jack Johnson, the boxer.
Jack Johnson, the boxer, yeah.
Yeah, it was put in place before that, but it was most famously used to prosecute him.
Yeah. So. And that had to do with them frowning on interracial stuff at the time. It was really kind of a racist application of it.
It's true. Back then it was, but it's kind of evolved over the years, and it's been used for different kinds of prosecutions. They've used it to prosecute people for polygamy and different things like that. So it's kind of been broadened and amended a bunch over the years, but it's still around. So,
well, sex trafficking is something that it should be used for.
I 100% agree.
That's a good law if it's used for that, to rescue people that from a life such as that.
That's right. Well, that's going to do it for this episode. I mean, I think we kind of an interesting case because it's kind of close, and it's something that's kind of almost unbelievable that it hasn't been properly investigated yet, but at least it is now, is all we can say.
It's just a head scratcher to me because they talked about in that article how it was like an out in the open secret. You know, there was all kinds of people in that area that knew all about it, and they knew the players that were involved in it, but nobody said anything.
Hiding in plain sight.
Yeah, they just didn't talk about it because none of them knew if the chief of police or whatever is involved, maybe you end up in jail if you say anything about it, you know?
It's like my mom always used to say, whenever you were looking for something and you couldn't find it, mm-hmm. and then you find it and it was right where you were looking for it.
Yeah.
So if it was a snake, it would have bit you.
Yeah. Well, I always heard, you know, people say, you know, it was in the last place that I looked. Well, no wonder. Well, you're going to keep looking after you find it? Of course it was in the last place you looked.
Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Dr. Lawyer Indian Chief.
We're proud to be coming to you almost live from Smurl Studios, high atop Three Last Mountain.
And we want to thank Audio Boom for being a part of their network.
And we also want to thank the McElroy Stable of Podcasts for helping give us our start. Their podcasts include Bim Bam, Sawbones, Still Buffering, and many other fine offerings.
If you have the chance, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you liked us. And if you didn't, don't bother.
You're not supposed to say that.
You're going to edit that out though, aren't you?
Why? You never did.
Thanks for listening. This has been Court Appointed. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. I am just a dude. Hello, and welcome to Tommy's Random Thought. Today's random thought is reimagining the police. As I've said here before, I listen to Lester Holt every night to get my national news. I like Lester. I consider him an old trusted friend, and I think he does a great job delivering the news. But I have a growing concern for Lester. It seems that almost once a week he is having to do a story on police killing an unarmed black man. He delivers this news with a calm intensity and sticks to the facts. I feel like, though, at some point, enough is going to be enough, and Lester will not be able to calmly tell us of it happening yet again. I keep expecting that one night he is going to finish the story and then look straight in the camera and exclaim, "God damn it, when are you white people going to quit killing us?" Who could blame him? Something has to change. Something big. I feel like the whole defund the police chant is not the answer. It won't help to simply weaken the police force. If the police feel threatened, then my guess is the situation will only get worse. My question is, why do we expect police to be social workers, couple counselors, child welfare advocates, mental health experts, and crime investigators, just to name a few? How many of our police do you think are capable of wearing all those hats? If you ask me, the whole hierarchy is set up to fail. They simply can't be as effective in covering all of those different aspects or be kept up to date educationally in changes of best practices concerning all of these different criteria. To reimagine the police, let's think about what parts need to be a gun-carrying police and which part needs to be trained in a specialty such as de-escalation of domestic situations or criminal investigating. What if there were mental health experts that operated as police but without guns and with much more intensive training in communication, de-escalating situations, and understanding what help options may be available? What if there were some people trained in how to deal with people under the influence of something? While they may be guilty of a DUI, they should not be sentenced and executed by being shot in the back because they made a drunken bad decision to run away. Likewise, why do you need to be a cop to be an investigator? I think people could be trained more thoroughly in investigative techniques as well as the law. Unless you are going to make an arrest, why do you need a gun to try and find out who committed a crime or to gather evidence to prove a case? How many times do guilty people get off because someone involved in an investigation didn't do things correctly out of frustration or merely oversight because they didn't realize something they did was not legal? On the other side of that, how many innocent people are arrested or found guilty because someone felt that pressure to make an arrest or close a case or because they had a hunch and just made the evidence fit? Isn't it worth neither of those things happening and that only the correct person is held accountable for a crime? There is a lot more that would need to be discussed, but this is just some examples of what I think might be possible if we really thought about it. Maybe the biggest improvement that might be found is that police can spend more time on actual police activities for which we need an armed and trained protective force. They can concentrate on proper handling of situations and have support people to assist, and then maybe better decisions will be made and unarmed black men or women do not have to die at the hands of police. Black lives do matter. This has been Tommy's Random Thought.